morning. On Wardrobe Kitchen Clothing. My name is Betsy Lewis Holmes, and I'm the student representative for the Design History Society Executive Committee. And we have two papers today. We're going to do them both back to back and then have time for questions. So first is Catherine Elliott, and her paper is called Clothing Soldiers, Development of an Organised System of Production and Supply of Military England between 1645 and 1708. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here. I would like to start with a quote from General George Monk from 1671. A general of an army must make it his principal aim to begin well and then not to omit anything for the preserving of what he hath gotten. He ought to be provident in taking care for clothes, shoes, stockings, and shirts. He must foresee and provide that none of all these things fail him in the execution of his designs. As this quote illustrates, clothes played a significant part in a soldier's life. Whether common soldier, officer, infantry, or cavalry, clothing was a basic need for the soldiering man. Just like food and the provision of weapons and ammunition, it was integral to the soldier's successful functioning. And as noted here by George Monk, it was the responsibility of the leading officer, the general, to ensure that adequate supply systems were in place to enable the punctual distribution of goods to satisfy the soldier's basic needs. This paper will set up and identify the basic needs that a soldier's clothing of this period had to satisfy, divided between the physical and psychological, and exemplified by the provision of warmth, protection, and identity. A consideration and analysis of the processes and systems of supply in place between 1645 and 1708 will follow, in order to identify changes in the way that the English military man was clothed across a period that has traditionally been viewed as one of little development. The subsequent discussion of objects alongside official clothing contracts and documents concerning supply will attempt to investigate the success of these different supply systems according to their ability to satisfy the physical and psychological needs essential for a soldier to function successfully. Most notably, this paper will draw upon the unique examples of late 17th and early 18th century sealed pattern garments in the Army Museum in Stockholm. These objects are both excellently preserved and illustrative of the process of manufacturing and storing exemplar garments as reference records. Importantly, they indicate the manner in which similar supply systems were developing across Europe, including England. The Swedish examples discussed here are of particular importance because they seem to be the earliest and unique survivals of the late 17th century military uniform design process, to be explained later. The unique survival of this material is partly due to meticulous collecting and preservation by the Swedish authorities throughout history, as well as the many misfortunes that have befallen many of the other large European military stores. The large number of fires in the English stores since the 1600s has meant the destruction of all stored pattern garments from this period. On the most practical level, clothing provided protection from the elements and was one of the only things that would keep the soldier and officer warm and sustain him throughout the grueling marching schedule when having to sleep out in the open, as described in many first-hand accounts. John Gwynne notes, "We were fain to march day and night. I never put off my boots for 6 weeks together." Certain items of clothing were also imperative to cleanliness, such as the linen undershirts that soldiers wore. Many of the clothing contracts issued between 1645 and 1664 note shirts as a separate and essential item that made up the suit of clothing supplied to the common soldier, as can be seen in this order from around 1645. While the rank and file soldier would have had little means to keep any item of their clothing clean through regular washing, the linen undershirt was nevertheless an important purifying layer that must be considered, especially in relation to the many men, both regular soldier and officer, wounded in battle and subject to dirty living conditions. As illustrated by this example of linen of bloodied in battle and in Captain Richard Atkin's description of his injuries on the 13th of July 1643. "For want of a shirt, my wound having bloodied my linen, I became so lousy in 3 or 4 days that I could not tell what to do with myself. And when I had got a shirt, which was not till we took bath, my blood and the sweat of my body has so worn it that it fell off into lint." The quality of the clothing supplied to the common soldier, however, was sometimes substandard. Vigorous complaints were made about many of the garments produced by military clothing contractors. Captain Bromley stated that the breeches were cut so narrow that men were not well able to get into them without tearing. Many of the sleeves of the coats were so short as that they came but a little below their elbows, and for breeches they were so scanty they did rip in the hinder seam. It is also recorded in many sources that after battles the dead were stripped of their clothing by surviving troops, as described in Sir Richard Bulstrode's account of the Battle of Edgehill. After bringing up his father's body, he found him stripped with several very dangerous wounds and that he was still alive. This practice is further illustrated in a detail from a Swedish painting from 1634, where, just hopefully you can see, circled in red, corpses are being plundered at the Battle of Nordlingen. For a 17th century soldier, the acquisition of textiles and clothing was equivalent to the acquisition of a material asset, and had the power to supplement their limited pay. When prisoners were taken, well-dressed men would be made to strip so as to ensure blood did not damage the value of the clothes. Clothing, therefore, could be used as currency. It could replace old, worn clothes, or it could be traded. Most importantly, if the supply of clothing was lacking, the practice of stripping prisoners or the dead after battle could ensure a soldier's survival. Clothing also functioned on a psychological level, symbolically representing morality, as Eileen Ribeiro illustrates. Clothing was part of a complex process where internal morality was represented by the kind of clothing and colours worn externally. For some soldiers, their clothing could represent their dedication and allegiance to their regiment or the king. As John Gwynne illustrates in his recollections of the Civil War, "Upon my desire to know how they came to be so barbarously used, told me because they would not part with their new clothes, which troubled them not so much for the want of them to cover their nakedness, but that they were the king's gifts unto them, which they prized as their lives." Allegiance and identity were also represented in flags or standards through which each company of soldiers and officers were bound together in battle. The importance of these colours or standards cannot be underestimated. Soldiers would die to protect them and prevent them from being captured. Soldiers were only paid when in their colours, therefore, unless the individual was under the command of his regiment standard and most likely dressed in his regimental coloured coat, he did not earn as a soldier. To understand how the English soldiers and officers were clothed across this period and to what items such an important role was attributed, it is necessary to investigate the means by which the soldiers and officers were brought into the army and clothed. During the initial stages of the Civil War, between 1640 and 1644, parliamentary and royalist forces were raised and supplied according to a system that was in use across Europe from the beginning of the 17th century. Men were brought into the army or raised only when needed, and once a conflict ended, the forces were disbanded. Supply systems to clothe, feed, and pay the soldiers and officers of these forces was therefore put in place only as needed. England's geography as an island, and therefore its physical separation from mainland Europe, where many of the largest conflicts during this period took place, meant that English mercenaries that made soldiering their business and English soldiers that were raised for service in these foreign wars had to travel away from England to fight. The Civil War on English soil, however, made it necessary for forces to be raised to fight within England. The resultant forces were made up of three main elements: well-trained mercenaries who'd fought in wars across Europe, men raised through commissions, and those that volunteered to fight. The clothing for this force was supplied to the soldier according to the system of off-reckonings. The clothing was rented at a certain price per day, with an amount deducted when the soldier was paid in order to pay off his debt. A 1640s figure from Cromwell House gives an indication of what the musketeer soldier raised through these methods might have looked like, with a short coat, knee-length breeches, low-heeled shoes tied with ribbons, stockings and a musket. Because of the low pay the rank-and-file soldier received, only about 9 pence per day, and the fact that much of it was used repaying the officer who had originally purchased their clothing, they ended up with only a few pence a day to survive on and were in constant debt. In 1645, the parliamentary forces began a process of reorganisation, which led to the development of the new model army. This newly formed force established a system of supply regulated by centrally controlled organisational bodies: Parliament, the Council of State, and the Committee of the Army, purchasing the necessary items and distributing them through the Ordnance Office. This structure enabled the resupply and reclothing of a very large number of men in less than a year. As a rule, one suit of clothing was provided to each soldier per year. This usually consisted of a coat, breeches, undershirt, stockings, and shoes that had to be produced roughly in accordance with a set of patterns or designs held by the Ordnance Office as exemplars. At this point, there was no standard colour used for any of the garments provided to the common rank and file soldier, and as such, the soldiers would be clothed in garments of a variety of colours in varying conditions. By 1655, it had become the accepted practice for all common soldiers' clothing to be provided by a central body and not by the individual commanding officer, and was issued through the Ordnance Office, which aimed to produce garments of the same quality and style. This development meant that fewer officers were left out of pocket when their men deserted wearing coats that still belonged to them. After the Restoration in 1660, as civil unrest in England continued, Charles II raised a small, permanent standing army to ensure civil peace and incorporated many of the commanding officers from the New Model Army. Despite their previous allegiance to Cromwell, Charles II saw the importance of having a standing army that would be ready for war at all times with knowledgeable and successful officers. This permanent army was both cost-efficient and well-trained and formed the core of Charles II's English army, to which more troops could be quickly added in times of war. Consequently, these troops were subject to regular inspections and parades that called for the regular and effective supply of clothing of an adequate standard, colour, usually red, and design, as illustrated by this painting of Charles II's army departing Holland. Throughout the 1660s and 1670s, the English standing army saw relatively little combat, as such soldiering became a profession that was less dangerous and provided opportunities for the lower levels of society. It also enabled the more regular and reliable supply of pay, food, and clothing. For example, by 1678, as this print goes some way to illustrating through the figure's uniformity, each man of a newly raised garrison was supplied with a cloth coat lined with baize, one pair of kersey breeches lined with pockets, two shirts, two cravats, one pair of shoes, one pair of yarn hose, one hat edged and hat band, one sash, and also one sword and belt. The said clothing to be satisfied for out of the off reckonings of their pay, at 53 shillings in the whole for each man, a much more comprehensive suit than in 1645. The most significant development in military clothing supply systems occurred between 1707 and 1708. A regulatory system backed by the monarch was put in place. Responsibility was allocated to seven general officers for 2 months at a time, answerable to the Queen. Consequently, order and consistency was achieved. Every clothier's contract of goods had to submit to checks administered by the board and were only passed if the patterns or designs matched the sealed and stamped patterns stored as the standard, as illustrated by this later Swedish example. While the regimental officer still supplied these patterns for official approval, effectively by 1708, the English government came to supervise regimental uniforms, stipulated to be made mainly of red cloth. I will now move on to discuss briefly my first case study that looks at some of the New Model Army contracts between 1645 and 1646 to discuss in further detail the early developments of English military clothing supply systems. The contracts I'll be discussing illustrate the types of garments being ordered in bulk and in some cases outline specifications in size and quality of material. A close analysis of these contracts illustrates how the reorganisation of this force with a central body in charge of supplying the troops with clothing and equipment positively impacted the regularity and quality of supply. It also enables a thorough investigation of what specific items were supplied to the common soldier of the New Model Army and what system of regulation was in place. I'm much indebted to the work of Gerald Mungeme, who transcribed one of these contract books, which has made this close analysis possible. On the 9th of October 1645, at the Committee of the Army, a contract was made with Francis Butcher for 2,500 pairs of stockings, costing 22 pence per pair, to be the largest sizes and all made of equally good cloth. On the 23rd of September 1645, the Committee of the Army contracted with Edward Harris and Arthur Dude for 1,500 cassocks and breeches at 15 shillings per suit. These kinds of large orders specifying quantity, size, and quality are seen regularly throughout these contracts and indicate a concern for the provision of adequate clothing that would satisfy a soldier's needs for protection and warmth. The quantities ordered suggest that the troops were kept fairly well supplied with clothing as well as armour. Some of the orders from this contract book go into great detail, and as such provide a very good idea of what the items described may have looked like. On the 14th of February 1645, a contract was made with Mr. Rich Downs for clothes with coats of red colour and of Suffolk, Coventry or Gloucestershire cloth, made 3/4 and a nail long, faced with bays of cotton with tape strings that should conform with a pattern that was delivered to the committee. While red was prevalent across the new model army in the form of the coat, the contract still permitted differentiation and variety of colour in the breeches worn. The breeches were to be of grey or some other good colour, and made of redding cloth or other cloth in length 3/4, 1/8 lined, and trimmed, being suitable to the patterns presented. The suit supplied out of this contract would, therefore, have a coat of a specified colour, red, made from a limited choice of materials, well lined and of a very specific standardised length, but with breeches that permitted more flexibility in both cloth and colour. Red was not yet the uniform colour worn by the common soldier. The contract goes on to state that any person that undertakes to make the required provisions does hereby promise that as near as he can, none of the said provisions of coats, breeches and stockings shall be worse than the patterns presented to the said honourable committee, and that the committee shall have the right to refuse any of the provisions that it deems substandard. I have included this later Swedish infantry pattern coat to illustrate this process, as there are no English examples that survive from this earlier period. The development of a standard, therefore, provided a minimum level of quality, below which items would not be accepted. As such, it was in the contractor's best interest to produce goods that adhered to these rules. Many of the contractors employed, such as Rich Downs, appear repeatedly, suggesting that the quality of products they supplied was of a good and consistent standard, and they were trusted enough to be employed again and again. As a result, a greater proportion of the military clothing being produced under this new system of centralised regulation was of good quality, as compared with the output of the previous supply system, reliant on the individual officer's judgment. This second case study will take 4 unique military coats from the 1680s, preserved in Sweden's Army Museum, to study how France and Sweden influenced the development of military style throughout Europe, including England, at the end of the 17th century. They also provide a rare illustration of the early military design process. The involvement of most 17th century European countries in different wars across the continent led to the development of a pan-European network through which knowledge acquired by professionals that fought in these various wars, well-trained civilians and intellectually prepared civilians, were disseminated. This happened in a variety of ways, the most prominent of which was through military treatises, drill books and newspapers such as the ones seen here. As the work of Barbara Donegan illustrates, the development of newspapers that imparted information about the wars being fought around Europe, such as the Swedish Intelligencer, which included illustrations alongside the production of illustrated military treatises, can and should be placed at the centre of the discussion of the dissemination of military knowledge and knowledge of war throughout the 17th century. The most influential countries within this network with respect to the soldiers' and officers' dress were France and Sweden. From the 1650s, France became the fashion centre of Europe, while for much of the 17th century, Sweden was the foremost and most organised military power. The history of these 4 coats and their links to both France and Sweden uniquely illustrate the relationship between these 2 powerful countries and the manner in which knowledge and fashion were disseminated across Europe, with the long justaucorps style coat becoming the standard uniform throughout all European armies by the late 17th century. On first glance, these 4 coats look almost identical. They're all made of dark blue broadcloth with 2 pockets and many large round buttons. 2 of them have dark blue cuffs, while the other 2 have large red turned back cuffs, revealing the colour of the facing. In addition to this, all the coats are described in the museum's catalogue as French justaucorps type coats from around 1680. On closer examination, however, subtle but significant differences are evident in both the styling and decoration of these 4 coats. The provenance of these objects is unclear. They were initially thought to have been acquired in Paris by Swedish Colonel Niels Bilk, commanding officer of the Lifeguard Regiment. This is based on the fact that Bilk spent more than a year in Paris from 1675 to 1676, to purchase certain luxury items for the imminent coronation and wedding of Carl XI in Sweden. Bilk was commissioned to have made in France new standards for the Mounted Life Guards Regiment, and in 1677 he purchased broadcloth and lining for 1,000 coats for the Life Guards. He also bought 500 buttons and 1,000 hats. While there is no conclusive archival evidence that he bought any of these four coats, what is important about this attribution is that it demonstrates that Sweden was importing many different types of things, including fashions and materials, from France for military use from at least the 1670s. The most important decorative difference that appears on one of these coats is the shoulder aiglette. At this time, the aiglette or shoulder cord was a unique feature of the uniform of the French grenadier. It was used as a distinguishing mark of the grenadier and was only known in France in this period. This decorative feature strongly indicates the cross-communication between these two different European countries and possibly the French origin of this particular coat, as it is likely that this coat was bought in France and brought back to Sweden, where it seems to have provided the inspiration for further Swedish designs. The similarities, therefore, in material and colour used across all four coats, coupled with these differences in detail and styling, suggest a complex system of influence, interpretation and redesign between France and Sweden in the 1680s. The current hypothesis is that the coat with the aiglette, most likely French, served as inspiration for the Swedish uniform at this time, from which prototype designs in the form of the remaining three coats were created. These coats, therefore, provide an important link in the system of supply that has, for much of the discussion of 17th century military clothing, remained elusive, the design process. While there are many mentions in both Swedish and English sources of sealed pattern garments that were stored to provide an archetype for the soldiers' and sometimes officers' clothing, there is, however, very little information about how these designs were created and decided upon. The survival of these four justaucorps style coats importantly begins to reveal this process. At the very least, the in-depth study of these contemporary objects illustrates clearly how important France was as a European-wide fashion influence on the development of military uniforms across Europe at the end of the 17th century. In conclusion, I have tried to show that as the supply system changed across this period in England, clothing was more regularly supplied to the soldier in accordance with more specific regulations that therefore led to the more successful fulfilment of the soldier's essential clothing needs. The most striking developments occurred in 1645 with the resupply that followed the establishment of the new model army. And finally, by 1708, we see the large restructuring and formalisation of military clothing supply and pay systems to ensure that debts were regulated and that each soldier that entered the army was supplied with a certain set of clothing of a particular colour, material and quality. Finally, by looking at the dissemination of military knowledge and materials throughout Europe, and through object analysis, I have tried to indicate the broader movement of influences across Europe and provided, I hope, a glimpse into the corresponding development of design for military uniforms. Thank you.